rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California and Oregon to Pennsylvania and West Virginia, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org and whiterosesociety.org, podcasting from Apple's iTunes. Welcome back to our program. As a partisan lawyer for the Bush senior and Reagan administrations, John Roberts, no, we're not talking about the CBS News correspondent, John Roberts, the fellow that George W. Bush has appointed to the United States Supreme Court, or has, you know, recommended be put forward, has put forward, whatever the proper phrase is. Anyhow, the guy that Bush has trotted out here has so far, I mean, this is just what he's done so far. He's cut back on our civil rights by asking the Supreme Court to severely limit the ability of district courts to desegregate public schools. He's cut back on our civil rights and worked to ensure that the Voting Rights Act could not be used as a remedy in cases of actual discriminations against minority voters. He's worked against women's rights by fighting for a law barring doctors from even talking about reproductive options in many cases, and arguing that Roe v. Wade should be, quote, overruled, end quote. He's worked against free speech by arguing before the Supreme Court that political speech that some consider offensive, political speech, not, we're not talking obscenity here, we're talking political speech. If somebody considers your political speech offensive, it is not protected by the First Amendment, he has argued. The court, by the way, rejected his claim. He will now be on that court. Religious liberties. He's argued that this, before the Supreme Court, the public schools should be able to force religion on their students. Again, the court rejected the argument, but now he will be on the court. As a corporate lawyer, he threatened community and environmental rights by working to strike down new clean air rules. He's filing a brief for the National Mining Association, arguing that federal courts could not stop mountaintop removal in West Virginia, even if it devastates local communities. Working as a corporate lawyer for Toyota, he helped them successfully evade the American with Disabilities Act and fire workers for disabilities that they suffered over time on the job. He threatened public interest regulations by helping Fox News challenge FCC rules that prevent the creation of new media monopolies. In his 2 short years as the judge, Roberts has threatened individual rights by rejecting the civil rights claims brought on behalf of a 12-year-old girl who had been handcuffed, arrested, and taken away by the police for eating a single French fry in the Washington, D.C. metro. He's threatened environmental protections in an endangered species case where he wrote a dissent. He was in the minority, by the way, that would have struck down the Endangered Species Act as unconstitutional in many cases. And he voted to strike down the Geneva Conventions as applied to prisoners that the Bush administration says are exempt from international laws. He's threatened our human rights. How is a guy this extreme? How has he managed to have Democratic senators coming out on the morning talk shows and the afternoon talk shows yesterday saying, well, I think we can have a reasonable discussion about him? Jeffrey Feldman has some thoughts on that. Jeffrey Feldman is the founder, publisher, creator. What's your title, Jeffrey?
Editor-in-chief and founder.
Editor-in-chief and founder. Great. And chief cook and bottle washer, right? frameshopisopen.com.
That's right.
Frameshopisopen.com. And, Jeffrey, you have been writing brilliantly about framing for some time now. I've been noticing your blog, your website. What do you call it?
I call it a website. I mean, yeah. I do engage in some blogging, but I consider myself to be an essayist and an analyst. But I started out as a blogger on the Daily Coast and then moved over to my own site. The bloggers tend to post a lot more often, 5 or 6 times a day, and I like to put up one longer piece.
Yeah, and you're doing absolutely great. Do you have any training in NLP or psychology or marketing?
My background is in cultural anthropology. That's what I have a doctorate in.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of cultural anthropology, we have studied linguistics and the meaning of language and the meaning of people's behavior. So that's where my the bulk of my training comes from. And another skill that I bring to this type of work is work in the classroom, explaining complicated interpretations to a wide variety of people.
Yeah, well, you're doing a great job at frameshopisopen.com. You have suggested in one of your most recent essays on your website, frameshopisopen.com, that George W. Bush has successfully trapped the Democratic Party, the Democrats in general, and certainly I'd say all the commentators, the news commentators, all the bloviators on TV in particular, in the frame of polite politics. Describe that frame.
Well, the frame of polite politics is a frame that governs how it is that we're supposed to behave in political debate. It's really incredible, but long before the president announced this nomination to the Supreme Court, he had a bunch of groups that were working behind the scenes to push this idea that Democrats are obstructionists, that no matter what the president does, Democrats are sitting there waiting to block anything that the president advances. And so when the president nominates Roberts to be his next justice, in his speech, he makes sure that he tells the American public that he really has been deliberating long and hard, and that he looks forward to a respectful discussion to go on the floor of the Senate. All the while, he's got these groups, like the Judicial Confirmation Network, which is really just an organization that's doing the bidding of the president, that's pounding the airwaves over and over again with the same message, that liberals want to destroy America, destroy your home, that the court is way out of control, and that Democrats, all they want to do is block the public.
And so basically what they did is they succeeded in setting up in the minds of Americans, in the minds of Democratic politicians even, the original idea that the Democrats would be obstructionists no matter who was presented, and therefore when somebody is presented, we should discount whatever they say because we knew in advance they were going to say it.
Exactly. And he marches out this guy. I mean, Roberts is well known within legal circles, but was pretty much unknown to everybody else, and he has this disposition which was very angelic. And so Democrats, they just responded with, I think, trepidation. They were very nervous about saying anything that may look like they were attacking this guy who's got, you know, two beautiful children who were running around at the president's feet. And, you know, the Democrats were really concerned about looking like a bunch of bloodthirsty people who are willing to do anything to destroy the president.
Yeah, because this guy is Mr. Generic white bread American.
Exactly.
I mean, he's mom and apple pie.
That's what he looks like on the surface. But when you start to scratch below the surface, like you just described in your earlier segment, this guy is really way, way out there. And, you know, what the president does expertly is he sets up these groups that are at an incredible distance from him. He never mentions them by name. And they start running, you know, these ads and these talking points over and over again to set up this idea that Roberts is just a straightforward, smart guy, never has done anything controversial in his entire life. Meanwhile, if you start to look at it, you know, he's made rulings that do things like support secret prisons in Cuba, that he has been a part of advocating quite militantly for the abolition of Roe v. Wade and the elimination of privacy rights in this country. He's really quite an extreme judge.
So how, first of all, why do you think that the Democrats didn't figure out that they were being framed in the first place? And secondly, how do they deal with it now that it's already happened?
Well, I mean, first of all, I try not to heap too much blame on the Democrats for not figuring things out. I'm sure that there are people who have figured this out. I mean, the Republicans, we have to keep in mind, are very good at this kind of stuff. And they, you know, Rove, who we're coming to light, is quite an expert at manipulating the press. Look, what we need
not to mention
do,
Frank Luntz.
What's that?
Not to mention Frank Luntz. I mean, the evil genius behind so much of the use of the GOP language.
Exactly. I mean, Luntz is their master framer, and we've got this guy named George Lakoff, who has been very good at talking to Democratic leadership, but things are slow to move forward.
Right.
Look, what I think needs to happen is the Democrats need to change the story right away. It's something that I call stealing the ball. Rather than accepting the terms of the debate, the Democrats need to remind the public quickly and succinctly what is going on here. First of all, less than a week ago, the entire country was focused on a controversy involving the president. The president, as it turns out, misled the public using cooked-up information about Iraq's nuclear war programs. and he leaked information. His administration leaked information to destroy the reputation of a CIA official. All this was front page news less than a few days ago, and suddenly he stands up a judge, and all we're talking about is this nomination. So I think the Democrats need to stand up and they need to change the story. They need to say to the American public, look, what's going on here is that America is concerned about what the president is hiding. In the midst of this big concern, the president stands up somebody, and suddenly we're talking about a judge.
Yeah, now beyond that, though, I had I do a local program here in Portland, Oregon on AM 620 KPOJ, a clear channel station in Portland, before I do this national program. And we had Congressman Earl Blumenauer on, who's the congressman, one of the congressmen, member of the congressional delegation from Oregon, on the program. And I said, Congressman Blumenauer, well, you know, what do you think of Judge Rogers, Roberts? And do you think that the Democrats should be taking a stand here? And he said, no, I think we should keep our powder dry. And I'm like, You know, Earl, you just bought into the worst frame out there. I said, that assumes that it's a zero-sum game, that you only have a certain amount of ammunition. I mean, the Republicans for the last 30 years, every time somebody so much as squeaked, I mean, Hillary fires somebody in the travel office in the White House and they're screaming about it. You don't keep your powder dry. You point out, if you believe in your principles, if you believe that this guy is actually bad, you say it. And he was like, well, you know, we've got to fight wars that we can win. Otherwise, we end up with egg on our face. Hey, what's your response on that?
Well, my response is...
I'm paraphrasing him, by the way.
Sure. I mean, every fight that you don't show up for, you're guaranteed to lose. So the Democrats' decision that they are going to wait for the next fight is fatal. They can't do that. They need to look at this nomination as an opportunity, not as something they need to be cautious about. And the question is not whether or not Roberts will be confirmed. We have to fight that fight. We have to block this confirmation. But the real question is, what do we want to get out there and achieve in the process of this review? I mean, think about...
Even if this guy gets confirmed...
Even if it gets confirmed, we have to think about what story we want to get out there.
That's right.
I mean, I remember back to Clarence Thomas and that confirmation process. You know, the Democrats lost that. They lost that confirmation process. But the notion of sexual harassment, this incredibly important concept, was something that the Democrats were able to put out in front of the American public. And that changed the way the public thought about a variety of issues. That was a huge opportunity that the Democrats seized. I think that we need to seize a similar opportunity here. The public is incredibly concerned about the honesty of the presidency. This is a moment when people are very worried that the president is leading the nation in this cat and mouse game, that things go on behind closed doors, that an inner group of people have turned the White House almost into a private club that feels that it's responsibility to hide from the public. And the Democrats need to stand up and, I believe, make that case. Now, above and beyond that, they need to make their case for what type of court they believe that America wants. Here you've got a guy who, in every thing that he's done, seems to be a judge who obeys the Bush family.
And time to end that, right?
It's time to end that. We don't want judges who obey a president. We want a court that's independent, that's honest, and that is composed of equal portions of the population.
Yeah, and that's the new frame that we need to get out there. Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com. Check it out. Jeffrey, thanks so much for being with us today.
It was great talking to you.
Much appreciated. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 25 minutes past the hour. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website, if you want to drop into our chat room. Welcome back to Steve from his surgery, to Sue in London, whose ISP was down this morning and was finally got on, was able to tell us about what was going on in London subways. You probably caught the news on that. Kind of, you know, it seems like somebody trying to pretend terrorism or something. We'll see how this plays out, but it looks like somebody set off some blasting caps, and time will tell. Time will tell. And greetings to Rama in Vermont and to Coach Glenn in Oklahoma and Diesel Creek and Hobgoblin, all the folks in the chat room. Ben Birch in there. Hey, Ben, good to see you there from the great Midwest and WhiteRoseSociety.org. You can get into it. You can drop into our chat room if you'd like by going to TomHartman.com and click live chat. It'll get you there. Our program, by the way, brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, high technology for low prices. If you find this program of value and you need anything computer related, give Small Dog a call, 1-800-511-MAX, as in Macintosh, M-A-C-S, 1-800-511-MACS. Get their information, get their catalogs, find out what they have to offer. Repair, new, used, all kinds. If you need it and it's computers, Small Dog Electronics has it. 1-800-511-MAX, M-A-C-S. Andy Borowitz has his take on what's going on with Judge John G. Roberts, President Bush's nominee to replace Sandra Day O'Connor. He says that Roberts has made the case for his own nomination today, telling reporters that if confirmed, he's determined to be the most generic white male in the history of the Supreme Court. With a beaming President Bush at his side, Judge Roberts said that if he serves on the nation's highest court, quote, the nondescript American white male who is woefully underrepresented in this country at present will finally have a voice. Judge Roberts summarized the life experiences that had put him in touch with the needs of the generic white male, including a brief period in the early 1980s when he modeled generic men's sportswear for Kmart, as well as a later stint as a downloadable generic white male icon for Clipart. When President Bush praised his nominee for being both interchangeable and unremarkable, a poll taken just hours after the nomination was announced suggests trouble ahead, with a clear majority of Americans being unable to remember Judge Roberts' name. According to the poll, over 50% of those surveyed identified Mr. Bush's nominee as either Jim Roberts or Bob Roberts, with over 70% confusing him with CBS News anchor John Roberts, yet another prominent generic white male. For his part, President Bush appeared unfazed by such numbers, telling reporters at the White House, quote, I have total confidence in Don Rogers, end quote. Elsewhere, over 150,000 women in Great Britain submitted applications to become actor Jude Law's new nanny. That from Andy Borowitz, theborowitzreport.com. So, interesting, the news of the day. That said, it is it's getting a little dizzy out here. W changes his language from involved to committed a crime. I will not have leakers in my administration, says George. Depending on how you define, he says, I am a man of my word. Depending, of course, on how you define the word word. You gotta figure that out. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Scott in San Diego, California on the line. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom. Last night I sent you, along with a whole lot of other people, an email message that I had called the John Dean moment. I sent a copy to you, as I had used some of the information you'd given me. And
I got it.
Well, this is really weird. Anyone with an AOL address did not.
Oh, really?
Oh, really. Out of the 36 people that got this message, five of them were at AOL. The messages all bounced. So I tried to send them individually, figuring, okay, they got some kind of spam protector in there, and they're blocking my messages. So I sent them individually. They were blocked again individually. So I sent some of the people at random. I sent them a message. I'm trying to send you some info. First guy wrote back and said, I got this one. Second guy wrote back and said, what?
Amazing. Amazing.
That's really weird, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, Scott, keep us up to date on that. If you can figure out what it was in that memo that you sent out that triggered the spam filter. I wonder if it was the phrase John Dean or Treason Gate or something like that.
Could have been any one of those phrases.
Amazing. Amazing, because it was, you know, I got it from you, and it was short, and it was relatively generic, and to the point about, you know, Bush was hiding this stuff. Anyhow, 29 minutes past the hour.
For leadership diversity.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends.
Well, it's a strange old game to learn slow. One step forward and it's back to go.
There you go. Welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour.
Standing on the bridge. In the groove till you make a mistake. Sometimes you're the windshield, sometimes you're the bug. Sometimes it all comes together, but sometimes you're a fool in love.
There you go. Welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. 26 minutes now, I believe, coming up in a second or two. And, yeah, sometimes you're the windshield, sometimes you're the bug. I wonder if Karl Rove is walking around singing that to himself. Of course, we're going to talk about Judge Roberts. That's exactly what George W. Bush wants us talking about. But the reality is that we really have no choice. He has foisted this upon America. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about what he doesn't want us to talk about, which made the front page of the Washington Post today, which is that George Bush himself, now this particular take on it, spin on it, didn't make the front page of the Washington Post, but, you know, any thinking person can add two and two, that George Bush himself might be involved in Treasongate, that this thing may go all the way to the top of the White House. We'll get to that in just a second. First, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Patty in Texas on the line. Hey, Patty, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me. I just wanted to say with this new appointee, I just heard AP about half an hour ago doing their scroll on your station, and George Bush's quote was, universal democracy for the world. Now, with this new judge appointee, how can women, not that it's going to be overturned, how can we trust a man who defended the government at one point for, you know, reversing R.V. Wade? I mean, I know that
he didn't just defend the government. He was pushing for the rollover of Roe v. Wade. This was a case that was really about whether a Planned Parenthood program that was receiving federal funds could use the word abortion. And he took that case, and at the suggestion of Ken Starr, let's, you know, give him his talking points. Mm-hmm. It was Ken Starr who was his boss. He took that case and tried to use it as a lever to overturn Roe v. Wade, and the court would have nothing to do with it. And it was Sandra Day O'Connor who cast the swing vote that said no to him.
Well, I'm just curious what kind of pathetic case they're going to bring before the Supreme Court with maybe a mentally disabled person who was raped by a brother or something like that, that they're going to fight for life. And what case are they going to bring forth to the Supreme Court if he's appointed to where Roe v. Wade is overturned?
I guarantee you it won't be anything like that. It'll be something that is so abstract that most Americans won't even know what's going on. They're not going to make another Terry Schiavo mistake.
Well,
yeah, mark my words. Patty, thanks a lot for the call.
Hey, you're welcome. Thanks.
I agree with you, though, that we can't trust the Bush administration. We can't trust George W. And John Roberts raises huge flags in my mind. And anybody, any Democrat, any talk show host, anybody who says, oh, we need to wait, we need to get all the facts, we need to give him an opportunity to say what he has to say before the committee. Yeah, very well rehearsed, very well vetted. No, I'm sorry. That is exactly what the Republicans want us to be saying. And I'm not going down that road. This guy is toxic. His wife is an anti-abortion activist. This guy is toxic. He believes that George Bush should have the power to throw you or me in jail, and we would have no constitutional rights. All George Bush would have to do is say, oh, he's a terrorist. And boom, you lose all your constitutional rights. I'm sorry, the Constitution doesn't say, except when somebody's a terrorist, Congress shall pass no law restricting freedom of speech. Or except when somebody's a terrorist, your right to privacy shall not be violated. It doesn't say that. I'm sorry. And in particular, it doesn't say except when the president says somebody's a terrorist. I mean, we've been through this before. Abraham Lincoln rolled back habeas corpus during the Civil War and basically said, okay, the right of habeas corpus, the right, you know, the basic rights to a trial by jury, the right to confront your accuser, the right to make bail, this fundamental set of rights doesn't exist if you're possibly a Confederate soldier. It was a horrible mistake. And it got undone after the end of the Civil War. Let's not go down that road again. But that's the road that John Roberts would take us down. Is it Ogell in North Carolina?
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well. How do you pronounce your name?
I'll tell you. I am so excited. I don't even know when to start. But I'll tell you something. You know what is going on in this country? I'm an immigrant.
Uh-huh.
I am proud of this country. But what has happened in the last 5 years in this country should actually concern every well-thinking American.
I agree.
The President of the United States has lied to this country. The Vice President has lied. All the members of his cabinet have lied, and nobody, Not even the press in the United States has the guts or the audacity to question this administration.
Up until the last few weeks, yeah, by and large, you're absolutely
and
right.
I think it is a shame. We have lost over 1,700 young men and women, fathers, mothers, and brothers and sisters, and nobody has said anything. I'm a Christian, okay? I'm a Christian. But I'll be damned if I vote for another Republican. I will never vote for another Republican because these people are liars.
Yeah.
I think if the press in the United States has some ball, I think they need to challenge this administration because they have really destroyed the concept of this United States of America.
Yeah, I agree with you, O'Gallan, and I think that's very well said, and I suspect that there's a lot of Americans out there who are saying the same thing. That's why I think the Republican Party is in for a big surprise in 06, and I'll tell you, they're going to try and bring out another wedge issue. And, you know, gay marriage is kind of, now it's passe, right? It's more and more people are accepting of it, and they've got it through in as many states as they could. It's going to be flag burning. They're going to go back to what worked for George Herbert Walker Bush the first time he got elected, at the end of the Reagan administration. And it's going to be flag burning. That's the thing they're going to trot out. They're setting it up right now. I guarantee you. We'll see how it goes. But there will be some wedge issue there. Karen in New York City on the line. Hey, Karen, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Tom. Listen, I agree with almost everything that we've been discussing, except I'm not sure that this Roberts appointment might not be a blessing in disguise, in that, as a matter of fact, he's so reasonable on some things that at first I felt that maybe he was a plant, that Bush put him in there just to, you know, he was going to have some right-wingers protest until we
What's
got
he reasonable on, Karen?
Pardon?
What is he reasonable on?
Well, I really don't. I haven't read
nothing.
That much.
Nothing.
But I've talked to people who said that he listens. That
he's a nice guy.
He called Roe v. Wade already done with. I don't think he's going to.
Hitler loved dogs and children.
Yeah.
He's a nice guy. I mean, so is Goebbels.
But Tom, don't you think we could do a lot worse? I mean, don't you think if they yanked him,
No, because friendly fascism is the most dangerous form of fascism, Karen. If he had nominated Janice Rogers Brown, who has already come out and said that 1937 was the peak of the socialist revolution when Social Security came in, and we should do away with Social Security, we should do away with protections
uh-huh.
against minorities. If he had nominated her, that would be overt fascism, and everybody would go, oh, now we know what he's up to. Friendly fascism is the most insidious. This is the greatest danger to America, Karen, not the least.
I know. It's probably wishful thinking, but I just looked at him and thought, oh, maybe, just maybe.
Well, see, that's the way the media is spinning it. Everybody is like, oh, he's so nice. He's so
uh-huh.
cute. He's got beautiful kids. His wife is so nice. He only earns $1 million a year as a private lawyer for big multinational corporations. Uh-huh.
Do we know his client list at all?
Well, one of his clients was Jeb Bush in the 2000 election. He went down and secretly advised Jeb Bush as to how to stay out of jail while he was in the process of stealing an election illegally.
I'm sick.
Yeah, me too. It's grim. Karen, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you so much, Tom.
That's okay. I appreciate you taking the time and effort to call in. Bonnie in Burgettstown. Burgettstown where, Bonnie?
Near Pittsburgh.
Oh, great. Hey, what's up?
Well, I enjoyed your guest so much, your first guest.
Yes, Jeffrey Feldman is great.
Yes, I was screaming at the DLC types yesterday who are so worried that Rush and his sidekicks will say Democrats are undignified and obstructionists and have double standards. I wanted just one Democratic senator, for instance, to say in response to the Roberts nomination, something like, we're delighted that the administration chose someone bright, and we will honor and dignify the process, not by automatically rubber stamping the administration, but by dignifying the Constitution and the American people, and we hope that the administration will be dignified by expecting that from our deliberative Senate.
Well, you know what's amazing, Bonnie, is yesterday Dick Durbin was on the floor of the Senate, and he said, nobody challenges that this guy has, I'm paraphrasing now from memory, I saw the clip at least a half a dozen times or a dozen times on CNN yesterday. He says, nobody disputes that this guy has a great mind. Nobody disputes that he's a decent person. And at that point, CNN cut the clip. But Dick Durbin went on to say, but we have some concerns. And started listing the concerns. But that part of the clip never made the air. The CNN, all the news networks are out there basically trumpeting the message. Oh, he's a nice guy. Everything's fine. Don't worry. Democrats kind of like him. I interviewed two congressmen this morning on my morning program. And both of them were saying, well, it looks like, he's going to sail through.
Well, and then the double standards thing really upsets me, too. Just compare how dignified, as you explained yesterday, Clinton handled his nomination of advise and consent.
Yeah.
And compare that with W's, frame the debate.
Yeah.
Leaking a moderate conservative name and then doing a switch. Well, they have no shame. They have no double standards. They have no standards.
Yeah. Well said. Bonnie, thank you very, very much for that comment. You're so well said. Tony in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Tony, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
How you doing? You're the best kept secret north of the Pacific.
Well, thank you.
can you... I'm starting to connect the dots now about this, these people in the White House. Do you understand why now that Porter Goff was put in charge to make sure to plug up all the leaks?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Porter Goff is a partisan hack. He was put in charge of the CIA to purge the CIA of anybody who might have challenged the Bush line. And
right.
And that's what he did. I mean, as soon as Porter Goff went in, a whole bunch of people suddenly quit. You know, many of them publicly, a lot of them not publicly.
And specifically, he was going to just to back up or to guard the rear of information that's supposed to come out to make sure it stays in the rear.
That's right. And particularly the information about how the intelligence community was manipulated along with the American people in the build-up to this phony war, this phony invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Also, I was talking about critiquing that your guest came on, the right-wing hack that came on, and I know you don't want to recall any names.
Tuesday, you mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, man.
Evan, say it. Yeah.
Right.
I'm going to get him back on again. It is great having somebody who actually will say the Republican talking points out loud.
That's what I was trying to say. But he actually did it exactly the playbook line for line. He didn't talk about the crime. He talked about esoteric things that had nothing to do with. You know, talk about this family, talk about people who were there, but he never said, "Look, if you walk across the street and it says red light, you broke the law."
Yeah, I know.
Plain and simple. You didn't get that, but I wanted to. I said, please let me through, please.
Well, we'll have him back, and we'll give you a chance to take at him, Tony. How's that?
You take it, and okay. I love the bumping music. She has so much soul. Your producer?
Yeah, Louise, she's brilliant. Yep,
pass
she's
on
brilliant.
Pass
okay.
on my compliments, please.
I shall do that. Thank you, Tony. Thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. William in Alabama driving a truck. Hey, William.
Hey, how you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
How come all we keep hearing are how cute his children were? You know, I mean, next time I go to a job interview, I think I've learned something from him. I'm going to bring my kids with me.
There you go.
So that the man hiring me feels more sympathetic towards my plight because my kids are crawling around unruly on the floor.
Hey, it works for CNN.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, it just... You know, I don't understand it. I mean, when...
And here's the irony of it. While CNN is talking about the fact that his kids are so cute, they're not talking about the fact that he said that he voted as a judge to prosecute a 12-year-old for eating a single French fry in the Washington, D.C. subway system and said that we were justified in dragging her off, putting her in a windowless van, handcuffing her, taking her shoelaces away from her, putting her in a jail cell because she ate one French fry.
Well, that sounds fair enough to you, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's like, I think his standards for children of color are a little different from his standards of white bred children like his own.
Let me give you an example real fast, and I'll let you go.
Sure.
I used to work, one of my first jobs was mall security before I started driving a truck. I can honestly tell you that the prosecution ratio for minors as far as either black minors or white minors was higher for black minors, and the example being, we actually... had to apprehend a child, about a 12, 13-year-old child, at one of the stores in the mall for pocketing a 25-cent pack of glitter. They called Child Social Services. They called the local police department. They arrested the child. They convicted the child. And they wound up putting the child into a youth home for however long it was.
And you have now created a lifetime criminal.
20, 25 cents.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing that when I was a kid, they'd call your parents and bring them in, and that would be the end of that. I mean,
but
part of this, let's acknowledge this, William. Part of this is that there's been a breakdown in the American family as well, and part of that is the result of conservative economic policies that have devastated the middle class. You've got a situation now where 30 years ago, before Reagan declared war on the middle class, one person working could raise a family, put their kids through school, have enough time for vacations, time to spend time with the kids, have their medical expenses. parents is covered. Now it takes both parents working and sometimes working two and three jobs just to get by. And more than half of all the children in America are coming home to an empty home right now because of these insane conservative economic policies.
But you know the cool part? I got my $35 tax rebate.
That
helped me out so much. You just don't understand. I was able to get completely out of debt.
Yeah, there you go. 2%. 2% of GDP. Thanks, William, for the call. 2% of GDP. The entire gross domestic product, 2% of it, is going to the tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires for Bush's tax cuts here from the last four years. And we could fully fund all of the health care for all of the people, all the 40 million uninsured people in the United States for 1.7% of GDP. And yet 2% of GDP had to be given up for tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires. I mean, go figure. Right? Go figure. And now we learn the front page of the Washington Post, Valerie Plame's identity was marked as secret in that memo that George Bush got on Air Force One before it went to Karl Rove, before it went to Scooter Libby, and before they started dialing for dollars, calling up members of the press to out Valerie Plame. I'm telling you, this is going to go to the White House. If the American press will stay on it. And get back to the real issue of Treasongate here, which is the real, real concern before us. 10 minutes before the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. We're Jack Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Ted Kennedy, all victims of the same conspiracy. Was Chappaquiddick a setup? We're going to have Matthew Smith calling in from London in the next hour to share with us his theory in his new book, Conspiracy, The Plot to Stop the Kennedys. Fascinating. Welcome back to our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, high technology for low prices, 1-800-511-MAX, 511-MACS, for all things Macintosh, all things computer. For that matter, regardless of your computer type. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Pat in New Mexico on the line. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I would like to know what you think of the effect it would have on the Bush administration if enough people, the Democrats, progressive liberals, were all to go on strike in reaction to what's going on today. I'll listen to your comments off the air. Thank you, Pat.
That's an interesting story, an interesting idea. Unfortunately, a strike requires an organizing nexus, and there's not a good organizing nexus right now. However, the AFL-CIO is having their meeting. The International Labor Communications Association is meeting this weekend. I'm speaking at that conference in Chicago, and the AFL is meeting the following weekend, the same place in Chicago. This is all part of the big AFL thing. And hopefully a revival of the whole labor movement is going to come out of this. We'll see how it works out. Anthony in Shasta, California. Hey, Anthony.
How you doing, Tom? I wish I could get the last couple hours of your show because I'm on Sirius Radio.
Anthony, I'm sorry. I don't discuss my affiliates. You had a question?
Yeah. I heard this infomercial on earlier, not today, but I keep hearing it on Left Radio. It says about some companies that haven't been charged for taxes, like if they took paid the basic structure of the for business to pay taxes, they would have paid the government over $11 billion, but instead they didn't pay any taxes at all, and they actually built the government for
you're probably talking about a Hightower minute or something like that. What's the point?
We're about out of time here,
by the way.
Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, I just wanted to point out that I don't see how all the right wingers can keep pointing out how well they're doing or how well the Republican Party's doing when they're just stuff like that in their face. And I mean, how can they deny it?
They don't try to deny it. That's the thing. They're quite proud of it. We have massive welfare for them. I mean, you got this energy bill out of there that's going to stuff somewhere between $8 and $20 billion. A billion being a million, 1,000 times over. Into the pockets of the big oil companies as if they needed it, right, in the nuclear industry, and all the good buddies of George Bush and Dick Cheney. It's corporate welfare. And they're quite proud of it. They're very happy to take the money and laugh at us as they walk to the bank. I mean, that's the bottom line. It's the Republican way. It's the grand old party. Yes. As George Bush said, he calls them his base, right? The haves and the have-mores. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Thanks so much for joining us today. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. TomHartman.com gets you into the chat room. Feel free to drop in and say hello. We were going to have Matthew Smith with us. We're having a little trouble getting through to London right now. I don't know, maybe it's bombing hysteria or something. We'll see. We'll see if we can work it out. In the meantime, though, there's really, frankly, I think very important point that I'd like to make about what kind of America we would have if George Bush gets his way. I mean, this is the bottom line with regard to the Supreme Court. And of course, we must not forget that this nominee was trotted out when he was. Because the memos were coming out showing that Valerie Plame's identity was first sent to Air Force One before Karl Rove started dialing for dollars when George Bush was on Air Force One. And we need to be asking the question, and our media needs to be asking the question, what did George W. Bush know and when did he know it? That said, George W. Bush has said that he's going to nominate somebody to the Supreme Court who is in the mold of Justice Scalia or Justice Thomas. Let's take a look at the actual rulings, the actual writings, the actual statements of Scalia and Thomas, and get a sense of what kind of America they would create for us. This, I believe this is from the Think Progress blog. I'm not absolutely certain. My apologies on that. But I have all the footnotes on all this stuff. This is absolutely solid. Let's take first Justice Scalia. What would be Justice Scalia's America? Number one, people would lose the right to make their own medical decisions. Scalia has written that even fully competent adults have no constitutional right to refuse unwanted medical treatment. In other words, your doctor comes to you and says, you must be on that respirator for the next... Well, until you die, even though it's a terribly painful thing and you'd rather, you must go along with it. If the school psychologist says your child must take that Ritalin and you say no, according to Judge Scalia, you can go to prison. Number one. Number two, the government would control women's bodies and eliminate a woman's right to choose. Oddly, this is sort of like what's going on in Iraq right now. Have you noticed? Have you heard the news reports? Iraq, they're rewriting their constitution. Under Saddam Hussein, ironically, and this is certainly no justification, you know, I say this not to say that he was a good guy, it's just an irony. Under Saddam Hussein, women had rights. They had equal rights with men, by and large. They had the right to vote, they had the right to participate in civic affairs, they had the right to go to school, and in fact they did. Many of the professionals in Iraq are women, as in contrast to most of the rest of the Middle East. So now the Iraqis are rewriting their constitution. And in the process of rewriting their constitution, they have just written into the constitution that women will have rights except as it doesn't contradict Sharia law, Muslim law. So now if a woman wants to get married, she has to have the permission of her father. If a woman wants to get divorced, she has to have the permission of her husband. If a woman wants to go out in public and Sharia law says she has to be covered, she has to be covered. If Sharia law says women can't vote, women can't vote. If Sharia law says, you know, it is moving in the direction of the Taliban. And this is exactly, or moving in the direction of the Iranian mullahs, really. Because what George Bush has done is he's reinvented Iraq in the image of Iran because he bought into Ahmad Chalabi's, oh, we'll give you a happy war that'll make you a war president and give you lots of political capital, lies. Anyhow, Scalia is cut from the same mold. Not that much difference between radical activist right-wing Christians and radical activist right-wing Muslims when it comes to the way they view women. Scalia has repeatedly advocated overturning Roe v. Wade. He even believes women don't have the constitutional right to decide whether or not to use birth control or contraceptives that could protect them from sexually transmitted infections like condoms. Government and religion would be one and the same in Scalia's America. Scalia has written the people of faith should combat the tendency of democracy to obscure the divine authority of government. He issued one dissent that would require governments to fund instruction in ministry if they fund education generally. You get this? Scalia actually wrote in a Supreme Court case, if we're going to fund public education, we must also fund churches. His dissent to another Supreme Court opinion would have allowed state governments to require the teaching of religious creationism. But none of this rises to the level of his dissent in Lee versus Weissman, in which he actually argued for the elimination of the Constitution's requirement that government be neutral toward religion. You'll recall in the Constitution, where it talks about people coming in and taking office in the United States, it says that religion shall not be a test. Scalia says that should be undone. We'll get into more of Scalia's America and Justice Thomas's America in a few minutes. But first, it's time for our weekly segment where we dig into things that you might not have known you didn't know, you might not have known you did know, you might not have known you didn't even you needed to know. Perhaps,
you know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync and think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be? Could it be everything you know about the conspiracy to stop the Kennedys is wrong? Matthew Smith's on the line with us from England. Hey, Matthew.
Yes, hello.
Glad to have you with us. Your new book, Conspiracy, The Plot to Stop the Kennedys, is coming out in bookstores now. It's from Citadel Press.
Yes,
indeed. And you suggest that John, Robert, and Teddy are all the victims of a conspiracy?
Well, that's right. That's in accordance with information derived from a CIA man who was involved in the Bay of Pigs disaster and who spoke to the person that gave me the information.
And what was the CIA man's name?
I don't know.
I fear
that Wayne January, who gave me the information, didn't know either. However, he worked with Wayne January for several days getting a plane ready for sale. That is, Wayne January ran a company that had aircraft, and he had this rather big aircraft for sale, which he didn't want anymore. It was a DC-3. It had 25 seats, and it was bought just a few days before the assassination. And the
assassination of John Kennedy.
The assassination of John F. Kennedy. This was in Dallas, of course, at the Redbird Airfield, small airfield, and the Cuban CIA man, that is to say, the man who was born in Cuba, recruited into the CIA, and was a pilot. He believed that because of work that Wayne January had done for the government, that he was talking to a CIA man. So he was quite forthcoming. He said, for argument's sake, tomorrow, this is Thursday, the 21st of November in 1963, he said, tomorrow your president is going to be killed.
Hmm. Now,
and of course he was.
Yeah. Now you suggest in this book that Teddy Kennedy. I believe this week is the anniversary of Chappaquiddick.
That's quite right.
And in which Mary Jo Kopechne died.
That's right.
And you suggest in your book that Teddy might be the victim of a conspiracy.
Oh,
how
yes.
so? He wasn't
yes.
just, you know, drunk and drove off a bridge.
No. I don't believe that at all. The key to this, I mean, there are lots of aspects which have satisfied me about what I'm going to say. But the key is, how did Edward Kennedy react the day after the car plunged into Poucher Pond at Chappaquiddick Island? He was in Edgartown. He'd only got back in the middle of the night. And everything he did and said indicated he had no idea at all where his car was, neither Mary Jo Kopechne.
Now, could it be that he was just so drunk he didn't remember?
No.
Okay.
No. The circumstances were no.
So why did he confess to it then? Why did he
He confessed only to not reporting an accident, which is a very relatively minor offense.
Mm-hmm.
Which got him a sentence, which was, there was nothing to do. It was just suspended.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, Edward Kennedy was absolutely devastated when he found out about Mary Jo Kopechne. He went to the island that morning, and when he arrived there, somebody said to him, "Hi, have you heard about your car being pulled up from Poucher Pond and the girl in it that's dead?" And he was absolutely shattered to his very foundation.
Now, we only have about a minute and a half left. I'm sorry,
Matthew Smith.
Ahead. What makes you believe that Teddy Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and John Kennedy, you're suggesting they were all the victims of the same assassination, a plot to stop the Kennedys, or the same conspiracy, excuse me.
Well, that came from the survivors of the Bay of Pigs, who believed the Kennedys had betrayed them, and lots of people died in the Bay of Pigs, and the survivors made up their mind that they would get even.
And do you think that they still have it out for Teddy?
Well, no, not now, because what they wanted was to keep him out of the White House. They succeeded
in
that brilliantly.
Interesting. So Teddy, but why hasn't Teddy Kennedy said anything about this?
Well, Teddy couldn't, could he? Because he was between a rock and a hard place. If he had said, for argument's sake, "Hey, I had this other girl along the beach, and Mary was just sitting in the car waiting for me to take me back to the boat," there would have been further questions as, "Hey, he's out with two girls," etc., etc. He would have been finished altogether. At that moment, his wife was on a nearby island, and she was expecting a baby.
Yeah.
The whole thing would have absolutely wrecked his career 100%. He was very
and nearly
lucky
did.
To survive.
And nearly did, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, Matthew Smith, researcher, reporter, writer, author of the book Conspiracy, The Plot to Stop the Kennedys, in a bookstore near you. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Smith.
My pleasure.
And a fascinating story. You never know. You just never know where these things are going to lead. I'm not sure I buy all that, but you never know. 20 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. We'll be getting to your calls in just a moment. our live chat room you can drop into by going to TomHartmann.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there, TomHartmann.com. And just click the live chat button and drop you into our chat room. E.J. Dionne wrote a brilliant piece, In Defense of Success. I want to get to that. First of all, just tell you about it. Those are folks in our chat room, folks on the web, just, you know, you can Google it very easily. In Defense of Success, E.J. Dionne Jr. And hopefully today we'll have enough time to get to it. If not, I certainly want to tomorrow. First, I want to continue with Scalia and Rehnquist. What America would be like if all the justices were like Rehnquist and Scalia. But first, let's hear from Alice in Humboldt County. Hey, Alice, welcome to the Tom Hartmann program.
Okay. I haven't spoken with you for a while, but I've tried. But I think sometime my phone is being messed with.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Alice.
It appears to me that everything that Bush does is to the detriment of the people, including the latest appointment.
Well, it's not to the detriment of the rich white people. You know, the multimillionaires and multibillionaires in the United States are doing very well under George Bush, Alice.
Oh, I know. I know.
So it's not all the people. It's just most of the people it's to the detriment of.
Yeah.
Yeah. But okay. You make your point very well. Thank you for calling. That was your point, right?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you very much for calling and making it. It's much appreciated and always nice to hear from you. You're one of my heroes, Alice. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service with us. Victoria, our correspondent in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria, how's the belly of the beast today?
Hot.
Hot? Yeah. And they're not. And they won't admit there's global warming, right?
No, it has nothing to do with that.
Yes.
Not at all. No.
Yeah,
no.
People are dropping dead all over the United States, all over Europe. No, there's no warming going on. The polar bears are swimming around looking for icebergs. Oh, there's no global warming. Ah, me. So what else is what's happening in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, there's a lot going on Capitol Hill where they're all trying to get as much work done as possible before they all go home for a month, which, you know, is basically the plan of everybody in Washington except yours truly, who will be stuck here. So the House is debating reauthorization of the Patriot Act. The Senate has a
Where's
number...
Where's that going to go, by the way, do you think?
I think there may be some concessions in it. One of the questions is going to be in terms of sunsetting, whether the sunset should, say, be 10 years or 5 years or 4 years. The sentiment by some people feeling that 10 years really isn't even a sunset. That's just going to go on and on, and sunset should be briefer than that. But I think both sides are going to give a little on this, actually.
Interesting.
Senate Foreign Relations Committee is having a hearing on updating the U.N., which is...
Updating the U.N.?
Yeah, bringing the U.N. up to the 21st century.
Doesn't the U.N. do that itself? I mean, we're just a member. We don't run the U.N., do we?
Hadn't you heard?
Oh!
You missed that.
Excuse me.
You missed it.
I was asleep that afternoon.
You're not on the memo list, are you?
Apparently not. Okay, so how are we updating the U.N.?
Well, I'm not sure, but Newt Gingrich was testifying, so...
Oh,
sure.
God.
He had some great ideas,
Excuse
I'm sure.
Excuse me. Yes.
Yes. So we've got that going on. Meantime, a lot of Washington really is reacting to the bombings in London this morning. There's a press conference by leading Senate Democrats talking about security. Republicans also talking about this, and you know, a general sense that what are we going to do if they can't do anything about it 2 weeks after the previous bombing? Then what are we going to do?
Looks like this was just a copycat bombing.
Could have been. I mean, the British police are saying the intent clearly was to kill, but that doesn't mean, you know, anything necessarily. But the fact that they could do copycat bombings, considering that the security is very high, and cause utter havoc again, is very disturbing. And I think it's really causing a lot of Americans to be even more disturbed than they were the first time, because previously, with the previous major terror attacks, there's been the one and then nothing else.
Yeah.
And this time there's been two.
And these folks in London who are perpetrating these attacks are making it very clear that it has to do with British foreign policy, joining us in Iraq.
They are, yeah.
Yes. So at least as far as we know. Victoria Jones, thank you so much for being with us, Victoria.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. It's 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartmann.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program. It's the Tom
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Kareth engineering our program, flying the spaceship. Yes, a little more to the left. Welcome back. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website if you want to drop into our live chat room. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota on the line. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I was just surfing through your website here, and I was reading your last, I believe it was one of your last Common Dreams articles, Supreme Court, Media Ignore Possible Fascist Play.
Yeah.
And as I got to the bottom, you scared me. I mean, you are so prescient. I mean, 3 weeks ago, you saw this coming. You talked about Gonzalez being the possible nomination, and you write, "Will be the mainstream media will probably trumpet this guy, whoever they pick, as a moderate," and that's exactly what they're doing. It's not Gonzalez, it's Roberts, but man, you called it on the head 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, well, it's not like, you know, it takes a rocket scientist to do it, Tom. I mean, their agenda is pretty obvious. What's tragic is how the mainstream media in the United States are ignoring it.
I know, but I'm sitting there reading, I go, my God, he called it, and this is scary stuff, man.
Yeah.
I mean, oh, yeah, yeah, they're exactly saying what you said they would say. They're calling loyalty, and he's moderate, and he's a real nice guy, although you were talking about Gonzalez, but then you did put a disclaimer in there saying whoever they nominate.
Yeah, I said what they're gonna nominate is a fascist, and Alberto Gonzalez was the one who I figured was the leading candidate, and I suspect that he'll probably be the next candidate who gets nominated. But there was so much blowback from the right because Gonzalez doesn't have an anti-abortion record, and here you got Roberts, whose wife is an anti-abortion activist, so she was perfect, and so George was, you know, okay, here's another fascist, we'll take this one instead.
Should I pack my bags and get to Europe? Because this is scary.
No, I think that we need to work to take back America, Tom. I mean, that's the bottom line. We've got to aggressively start working to take back America. Thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. Back to Justice Scalia's America, because George W. Bush says he wanted to nominate somebody in the mold of Scalia and Thomas. So just looking at Scalia's actual decisions, the actual things that he's actually said as a Supreme Court justice, keeping in mind that most of the time he's in the minority. You get a couple more like him on there, he'll be in the majority, and America will change. I already shared with you that people would lose the right to make their own medical decisions, that the government would control women's bodies and eliminate a woman's right to choose abortion, that government and as well as birth control, that government and religion would be one and the same. It gets worse. In the Grutter versus Bollinger ruling, Scalia dissented, suggesting that affirmative action should be forbidden at state schools and campus diversity could disappear. He held that state colleges and universities can use affirmative action to increase educational opportunities. He railed against a ruling which held that state colleges and universities can use affirmative action to increase educational opportunities for minorities. According to Scalia, if you support affirmative action programs, you subscribe to the way of thinking that resulted in slavery. In Scalia's America, when the Supreme Court is made up of people like Scalia, people's bedrooms would be fair game for government intrusion. Again, as I said, I believe that this was originally written over on the Think Progress blog. I may be wrong. I'm going to track down the source of this, but it's all footnoted, and so it's very straightforward here. People's bedrooms would be fair game for government intrusion. Justice Scalia. Reproductive freedom, bodily integrity. Sorry, privacy. Justice Scalia has said he cannot find the word privacy in the Constitution. Well, the reason you can't find the word privacy in the Constitution is because in 1787, when the Constitution was first put forward, the word privacy meant use of the toilet. It wasn't called a toilet back then. It was called the privy. And you'd say, I need some privacy. It means I need to go to the bathroom. That you're going to step outside and use the outhouse. Or if you were very wealthy and you had an indoor outhouse, you'd step in, you know, you get that. Privacy. The word privacy meant toilet functions in the 18th century, in the 1700s. It wasn't until, what was it, 1860, 1870, something like that, Thomas Crapper invented the flush toilet? And our language changed as a result of Thomas Crapper's invention. And then the word privacy came to mean, you know, came to expand beyond just toilet functions. Now, we still refer to your private parts, and we still refer to the privy. as remnants of that time when the word privacy exclusively meant things having to do with toilet functions. But anyhow, that's why you won't find the word privacy in any of the writings of any of the founders. And yet they all believed in the right to privacy. They simply called it something else. Their language was quite explicit. They called it security, oddly enough. The Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. Now, you'd think that that's pretty explicit, right? If the police, if the executive branch, the FBI, if they want to search your house, they have to go to the judicial branch, to another branch of government, to the judiciary, and ask for a warrant, and they have to prove, they have to satisfy the requirements of the Fourth Amendment, supported by oath or affirmation, particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized, and no warrants shall be issued but upon probable cause. They have to convince a judge that there's probable cause that a crime has been committed. At least until the Patriot Act came along. And now you can have sneak and peeks. And you can have special tribunals. I'm telling you, this is a tragedy for America. In Scalia's America, private bedrooms would be open to government inspection. He wants to make it, he has suggested it should be made illegal for gay Americans to have private consensual sex, but he's even more radical than that. He thinks that it's actually okay for the government to make any sex between any consenting adults a criminal act if they're not married. In fact, according to Scalia, the government should even be able to make masturbation a crime. I can see the special police squads with their infrared goggles looking through people's windows. Civil rights and liberties would, quote, be ratcheted down to the constitutional minimum, end quote. Yes, that's an actual phrase from an actual speech by Justice Scalia. The constitutional minimum. In fact, the Constitution, I wrote a piece, an op-ed piece for Common Dreams some time ago titled Scalia, If You Want Rights, Pass a Law. Scalia actually made a speech where he said there is no right to gay marriage in the Constitution. If you want rights, pass a law. There's no right to abortion in the Constitution. If you want rights, pass a law. Excuse me, Justice Scalia, the way it works is if you want to take away somebody's rights, you pass a law. The founders of this country made it very clear that we hold the rights, we the people. The Constitution doesn't say you have the right to get married, you have the right to own a home, you have the right to have children, you have the right to eat, you have the right to drive down the street, you have the right to talk, you have the right to read, you have the right. It doesn't list the 5,000 things you can do that you have the right. It says you have the right to do everything. Unless we collectively get together, we the people, all of us, through our elected representatives, and decide that the society's needs are so great in a particular area that some rights need to be circumscribed. That your right to own private property, for example, is absolute unless we have to build a fire station or a police department or a road. And so the Fifth Amendment says then, you know, that right of private property ownership can be violated, although you have to be appropriately compensated. Just as one example. So the Constitution, what the Constitution says is we have all the rights. And the legislative branch does not pass laws to give us rights, as Scalia thinks. Clearly he has not read the Federalist Papers. He hasn't read the writings of the founders. Or if he has, he's limited it to John Adams, who was a flaming fascist. Scalia thinks that you pass a law to give people rights. Excuse me, it's the other way around. We have all the rights, and you pass laws to take away people's rights by consensus. Your right to keep a piece of your paycheck. And on it goes, you know, and Scalia doesn't get it. Women would have to pay taxes to fund public educational institutions that are only for men in Scalia's world. He thinks it's just fine to have state-funded institutions. This was in the case the Supreme Court voted in the case of the Virginia Military Institute, which it was exclusively male, and yet women in America paid taxes to support it. 8 out of the 9 justices on the Supreme Court said, that's wrong. If it's funded by women in the United States, they're paying half the taxes in this country. Actually, they pay a little less than half the taxes, even though they're more than half of the population, because women are still suffering the consequences of 7,000 years, essentially, of slavery, of being the property of men. And Scalia was the only one who dissented. Courts would no longer fight school segregation. In the Freeman versus Pitts case, Scalia said that the desegregation plans that schools are carrying out can no longer be, no, you can't do that anymore. He was in the minority again. He argued in the same dissent that school segregation can never be remedied because it's impossible to identify its causes. In other words, just give up. Go back before Brown versus Board of Education. This isn't about right and left. This is about present and past. Scalia wants to take us back before the founding of this country. I mean, he's just rolling us backwards. The police would no longer be obliged to inform people of their constitutional rights. Scalia and Thomas are the only two justices who support reversing Miranda. You have a right to remain silent and a right to an attorney. He said, according to Scalia and Thomas, African Americans can be excluded from juries because of their race. According to Scalia, he wrote a dissent. It would have weakened employees' rights to strike and to engage in collective bargaining. Says employers can refuse to talk to union representatives. Again, it was a dissent. He lost that case. One more vote on the court. End of unions. State laws that say that HMOs have to pay your medical bills, protect patients. Scalia says, hey, tough. He voted to overturn a patient's bill of rights that lets you get a second opinion if your HMO refuses to give you treatment. He signed onto a dissent that would have allowed local governments to charge controversial speakers large permit and police protection fees to prevent them from appearing. He says your cars can be searched any old time. He argued police should be allowed to set up highway checkpoints to randomly search vehicles. Forget about environmental protection. He made the perplexing argument that if all members of a community are injured by environmental pollution, a citizens group should not be allowed to file suit to enforce anti-pollution laws. He wanted to prevent the federal government from enforcing the destruction of endangered species. He wanted to prevent the EPA from stepping in to stop pollution when state agencies fail to do it. He says if bosses don't like your politics and you work for the government, your boss can fire you based on the political party you're a member of. As a mailman. And if you try to seek damages for your employee when you take time off to care for a sick member of your family, forget it. The Family Medical and Leave Act, Scalia thinks it's unconstitutional. Talk about taking us back. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Hank in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Hank, what's up?
Hey, a nice ranch you had going there, Tom. And we live in the free world, right?
Yeah, sort of. And that's just Scalia, by the way. I've got an equal list on Clarence Thomas here.
Yeah, and I don't know. I kind of agree with you yesterday talking about the terrorists. I don't think the American people have to worry about people in other countries. They better start worrying about our own government.
They need to start worrying about the terrorists in the White House.
Yeah, they are. As far as I'm concerned, the United States government is the largest terrorist organization in the world, and my hope every day is that, you know, you probably don't want to hear this, but I would hope that a modern-day Lee Harvey Oswald would step up to the plate
God
and
forbid.
Take care of,
God forbid, Hank. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to let you go there. I'm sorry. Number one, I don't think the government is a terrorist organization. I think, however, that we have people in this administration who are trying to use, who are trying to terrorize Americans, raising alert levels and things like that. They are using terror as a political tool, and I think it's wrong, number one. And number two, I would never, absolutely never say that anybody of any political stripe or any sort of behavior should be assassinated. That is, I'm sorry, Hank, you're off the wall. Just ain't going to go there. Amy in San Diego. Hey, Amy.
Hey, Tom. I really enjoyed your show today. And I just wanted to say that whenever I talk about, you know, we're going to lose, it could be that Roe versus Wade's going to be overturned, I always try to reframe it using your words to say it's not just abortion. It's medical privacy. So, like what happened with Terry Schiavo, right, could happen to any of us, because a lot of people, you know, abortion is such a tiny population that can affect, that people say, oh, you know, what's the big deal?
That's right. But Roe v. Wade is much bigger than just abortion.
Bigger.
It's about women's right to privacy.
Yes.
And actually, it's about all people's right to privacy, ultimately.
Absolutely.
But,
yes,
but, you know, specifically, it was decided with regard to women and you know, redressing a long harm.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks, Tom.
Amy, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. And thank you for listening. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website if you want to drop into our live chat room. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting, telling the truth that multinational corporations would really rather you weren't thinking about.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And what was the name of this ill-fated ship? And where did she go on her ill-fated trip? Guam and oil from Africa never thinks twice. The name of the ship, Condoleezza Rice. And the name of the ship, Condoleezza Rice.
Yeah, actually, there really is an oil tanker that was named the Condoleezza Rice. She was a member of the board of directors of Chevron, as I recall. I believe it was Chevron. And they named an oil tanker after her. And then when she became the national security director and presided over the biggest failure of security and intelligence in the history of the United States, they took her name off the ship. But, you know, to protect her, of course. I would say to protect the ship. I mean, would you want to be the captain of a ship named the Condoleezza Rice? I would have a little problem with that myself. Anyhow, thanks for joining us. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, TomHartman.com. Our website, Brian in New Jersey on the line. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I think Mayor Bloomberg is taking lessons from Scalia. Did you hear what he said today about New York police will start randomly searching bags and backpacks on the subways?
I did not, but you got to understand there's a certain level of paranoia, fear, panic might be
well,
a good
of course,
word.
You know, when the government starts conducting attacks against the people and they want to lock down a police state, that's what they're going to do. But
yep,
if they're going to randomly search bags, I think that's ridiculous. Either search them all or don't search any, because then you're going to start having profiling, and that's just wrong. You know,
so. Well, here's the conundrum, Brian, and this is why I'm not speaking out against what Bloomberg does, and that is that there's a reason why you have to have a driver's license to drive a car. Once you're driving in the public areas, you've stepped off your private property, and we, in order to participate in the public square, as it were,
right, you don't want to hurt anybody else.
We give up a certain amount of our rights, a certain amount of our privacy in exchange for the common good. We
right.
agree to, you know, have stop signs and red lights and things like that.
Right.
And for the same reason, we agree to go through magnetometers at airports, and if you know, and have our bags randomly searched. And so I'd suggest that randomly searching bags on a subway is not that different. In fact, it's actually less intrusive than what happens if you're going to fly on an airplane.
Yeah, but again, I don't like the whole random issue of it, because you're going to, again, start profiling people, and I think that's just, if you're going to do one, then fine, put the magnetometers there, but don't just...
Well, no, I disagree with you. I'm sorry. I think that it's appropriate to profile people. I think that it's, at least to a certain extent, I think it's extremely unlike the 70- or 80-year-old woman or a 4- or 5-year-old child is going to carry a bomb onto a train or an airplane. I think it's silly that we're paying to frisk a grandma at the airports.
Yeah. True.
Now, I'm not saying that, you know, people with brown skin should be profiled or something like that, but you know, is because certainly of the two major terrorist acts in the history of the United States, one of them was perpetrated by a white Christian guy, Tim McVeigh. So it's not, you know, but the fact of the matter is that I really don't think that Granny or, you know, little Susie represent a terrorist threat. So I think that a certain amount of intelligent profiling is actually a reasonable thing. And political correctness be damned. And, you know, we live in strange times, and we have to acknowledge that as well. But it's just a very, very difficult, one, I think, you know, in general. Anyhow, got to wrap it up. Thanks a lot,
Thank you,
for the call. We have another 37 seconds here. We for those stations, I had the pot in the wrong place and didn't fire off the spot. So if you're still hearing this on your radio station, we have 26 seconds to go. My apologies to the management of the stations. Under Judge Thomas's America, we talked about Scalia. Let's talk about Justice Thomas. Voters would lose effective protections from late racial discrimination at the polls. Thomas once offered such a radical interpretation of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that Justices Stevens, Blackmun, Souter, and Ginsburg responded by saying his interpretation would overturn American law.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, TomHartman.com. The website, Thomas Paine was the first American to call for an estate tax. Yes, Thomas Paine. The first American to call for an estate tax, in writing anyway, at least that I can track down. Teddy Roosevelt, a strong advocate for it. The theory being that if wealth became too concentrated in too small a number of hands, we would be in the same situation that England was in 1776. You would have an aristocracy. You would no longer have a democracy. That such concentrated wealth was actually toxic to democracies. Arguing the other side, we have Dick Patton, the executive director of the American Family Business Institute. I would suggest, well, I was going to say disingenuously named, but perhaps not. A nationwide organization of family business owners devoted to the permanent repeal of the federal estate tax, which you call, Dick, the death tax.
That is correct.
Okay. Make your case.
Well, the death tax is a tax against what a person has gathered in the course of their life. A very long time ago, in the 1700s, you're mentioning Thomas Paine, let's reach back to that era. John Locke said that if a man has the ability to work hard during his life and save and gather and invest, then he should also have the right to give or bequeath whatever he has gathered in the course of his life to whomever he chooses.
That would have been actually in the 1600s. John Locke was born in 1624.
That is correct. Yes, 17th century, 1624. But that thinking became really the philosophical basis of, you know, the concept of property rights, which of course is a part of the thinking that went into the American Constitution, into the American free enterprise system. And the death tax really is a tax against property rights, is a tax against what a person has accumulated through the course of their life. Not only have they accumulated, but they've paid all of their taxes through that process every step of the way.
Dick, do you think that we should pay sales taxes?
Should we pay sales taxes?
Right. Do you think that there should be sales taxes?
Oh, there's sales taxes all over. In fact, there are lots of.
No, but I mean, do you think that sales taxes are justified? Do you think that it's ever justified for there to be a sales tax?
That's a justifiable form of tax.
Okay, then how is a sales tax, which is taking money from me, which I have accumulated, any different from an estate tax, which is taking money from me, which I have accumulated?
No, there actually is quite a difference, because most taxes are what we would call transaction taxes, And, you know, we can debate endlessly as to whether they're right, whether they're wrong, or how high or low they ought to be. But what they are is they are taxes, whether it's an income tax, you pay as you earn, a sales tax, you pay as you transact, an excise tax, you pay as you buy your tires, for example. But the estate tax is a tax against that capital which has been accumulated, whether it's in the form of a family farm or a family business or somebody's IRA or their the savings of their lifetime. And as, for example, a business person has worked their way through their life, they have put their capital at risk, they've worked very hard, they've paid all of their taxes every step of the way, you know, whether it's city taxes, county taxes, state taxes, employment taxes, you know, Medicare taxes, corporate income taxes, personal income taxes. When all of that is done and there is something left over, this is a tax that confiscates about 50%, if you qualify for the tax, about 50% of what's left over, and it confiscates it at the time that you die.
Actually, according to the Internal Revenue Service for the year 2003, when the tax rate, the top rate, was 50% on an exemption level of $1 million, estates in the $5 to $10 million range paid the highest actual rate, 29%, and estates worth over $20 million paid an effective rate of 16.5%.
Which is really rather amazing. And actually, if you vaulted beyond that, and you won't see these numbers in the IRS because they completely escaped, but an awful lot of the truly, truly sizable fortunes in America, because of the tools that they have available to them and the lawyer, armies of lawyers they have, many of them escape death taxes altogether.
So
and you're absolutely
so now,
right. The people who are carrying the biggest burden of the death tax are the family businesses and the family farms.
The people who have estates that are worth $5 to $20 million. First of all, I know you guys love to toss out the family farms. I'm assuming that you saw the piece in the Washington Post, or was it the New York Times? The Seattle Times, actually. Oh, it was originally the New York Times, David K. Johnson.
Yeah.
The number of farms.
I saw the piece and I saw the document that it was built upon, and the document is relatively fallacious. But I will tell you this, that the
they said you guys were unable to find one single farm.
That
has been lost as a result.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, that's
this is the
that's
the article is few
article.
Farms stuck with the state taxes report finds all but 27 farmers. This was for the year 2000. All but 27 farmers left enough assets.
I know exactly which one you're talking about, and that was there was somebody from one of the farm bureaus who was testifying before Congress, and they were talking about family farms being lost and so forth, and so that they were asked, you know, give me the names of any family farms who have been lost, and that person was totally unprepared, but it went into the record, and that was the answer that article was falsely
No, actually, this
now,
is,
I will tell you
they,
this.
They did a study on this, Dick, and they found 1,659 farm estates that qualified for the tax. And when this is in 2000, when the threshold was $675,000. And in that, only 300 of those farms actually paid any of that tax, and they were able to find a total of, I'm looking for this here, farms in particular are not in jeopardy because of estate tax. They weren't able to find any who actually lost their farm because of an estate tax. One of the reasons why is because people buy insurance policies to shield it. They found 95% of estates left by farmers were worth $3.2 million or less, an amount that a married couple could shield from tax. And they go through this whole thing. But maybe we agree on something here, Dick. And let's talk about this for a minute. I will grant you that the Walton family, for example, who are pouring millions of dollars into Republican coffers and organizations like yours to eliminate what you call the death tax, what at law is called the estate tax or the inheritance tax,
right,
that folks like the Walton family, by and large, are not paying so much on this tax.
They really aren't, yeah. There are tools that are at their disposal with their armies of lawyers
that
allow them to get out of it.
Right, and it's nailing people who have estates that are worth between $5 and $15 million. In this day and age when a middle-class home in Los Angeles can be $1 million, $5 to $15 million is not rich. It is, you know, well off and comfortable, and, you know, by the standards of a lot of people, I mean, they'd say, well, I'd love to have that kind of money. But it's not the kind of riches that when Jefferson was talking about this said, you know, we don't want to have riches accumulate in the hands of private enterprise to the point that they become a threat to the state. And at what point At what point, and I think that the threshold on the estate tax should be increased. I think it should be increased radically. I think it should be $50 or $100 million, frankly. But at what point is accumulated wealth in the hands of a very small number of people toxic to society? If we reached the point where, say, 95% of all the wealth in America was held in the hands of, say, 1% of Americans, would you consider that destructive?
Well, first of all, if that happened, it would be because the American free enterprise system was destroyed. And
how so?
And
that's exactly
that is,
how laissez-faire capitalism
not,
works.
No.
That's how it worked in Europe.
No. In America, this is a meritocracy where anybody can step in and compete.
Oh,
and
yeah. Try coming up with an operating system to compete with Microsoft.
Well, keep in mind, Microsoft started out in a basement, and Microsoft, you know,
they stepped into a vacuum when they, you know, when Microsoft started out, it didn't start out in a basement, and Bill Gates wasn't, you know, a poor guy.
I know, it started out in a garage in New Mexico, but the fact of the matter is, you know, Bill Gates, while he may have built an enormous personal fortune, I don't think that there's any single person in the history of America who created more millionaires than Bill Gates. So he gave incredible capital accumulating opportunity to thousands of people.
And Bill Gates and his father are out there, and Bill Gates and his father are out there saying, "Keep the estate tax." In fact, his father wrote a book about it.
Let me correct you. Bill Gates is not saying a thing about it. Bill Gates the elder, his father, is saying, "Keep the estate tax." And when he was testifying before Congress, one of the members of the subcommittee that he was testifying in front of said, "So tell me, how much of the Gates family estate is going to pay death taxes?" And since he was under oath, he said, "Well, none really." So
your point and my point is made. Why don't we have an estate tax I mean, you said the American system, the American free enterprise system, prevents, for example, a situation where 1% of people own 90% of the wealth, which is about where England was in 1776. And my suggestion is that the reason for that is because we have things like inheritance taxes.
No, not at all.
Okay, then what differentiates us from England in 1776?
Their wealthy aristocracy was given lands and estates because of their service to the king, and it spawned because the king originally was the title holder to vast lands and then passed this to the aristocracy, and they had a system called primogeniture so that they could preserve the aristocracy where everything went to the oldest son. You know, all of this stuff has nothing to do with how America is. We are not an aristocracy. We do not have a government that's handing out lands and estates in exchange for service.
Well, you're clearly not in the mining business, Dick.
I'm sorry, what?
I said you're clearly not in the mining business. You should look at all the land that's being handed out to people in the mining and oil drilling business by this government, our public lands that are being passed out at pennies on the dollar. But that's a whole other rant. Dick, we've only got a minute and a half left or so. Are you willing to acknowledge that there might be a point when accumulated wealth in family hands over generations is toxic to democracy?
No, I'm not willing to admit that.
Okay. So that's the fundamental difference. Ultimately is the point at which we disagree, I think. And that's where we just have to let our listeners make up their own minds.
You bet. I will tell you that, you know, what would be toxic to America is if the estate tax increases so that as people die, more and more of America's assets and capital is accumulated by the government. That would be a danger to America as we know it.
Except that the government tends not to accumulate capital, it tends to redistribute it. You know, the government,
land.
The government gets land, and you've got cattle grazing on government land, you've got people walking on government land, you've got parks on government land, you've got, you know, it's...
I will say this, that capital is actually much more beneficial to all of America in the hands of the business owners.
So do you think our fire departments should be privatized?
That's not even a part of this discussion. Come on.
But you're suggesting that, you know, government land is better in private owners.
50% of all of the jobs in America come from America's family businesses. And America's family businesses are in a position where they're at a competitive disadvantage to their publicly owned or the global corporations that they compete against, who do not have to part with half of their capital every generation, but American family businesses do.
On that, I agree with you. And that's why I said I think the threshold should be dramatically increased. Dick Patton with the Executive Director of the American Family Business Institute, nodeathtax.org, his website. Dick, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Shake it up. Shake it up.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. 1-866-889-8894. George in Coos Bay, Oregon, on the line, listening on KBBR. Hey, George, what's up?
Hello again, Tom. When you're talking to this gentleman that's so concerned about the poor downtrodden millionaires
and billionaires
and the death tax, I hope you do remind us, as only you can, of what is increasingly called the birth tax, which is about a $25,000, $30,000, $40,000 tax on every kid that's born in America today.
Right. It's actually pushing $100,000 now. It was around twenty-two thousand dollars when George Bush came into office. It's now
I'll
over
hang
100.
Up and let you run with it because
that's just
know, every time I hear about these poor bleeding millionaires, I just want to go.
I know. Well, you know, doesn't it just, you know, pull your heartstrings, George, though, to think that, you know, some millionaire, some multimillionaire, some billionaire, you know, somebody worth $30, $40, $50, $100 million, $500 million, $1 billion, $5 billion might have to give up a little bit of that when they die.
Well, and think, I mean, his heirs worked so hard for that. They had to be real nice to Dad when he was, you know, in his declining years and marrying the trophy wife and all that. And they just had to be nice to him anyway, you know, and
That's hard work. And the reality is that the estate tax, as it's currently constituted, allows people to pass along wealth to their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, I mean, seven generations down the road, so that none of them will ever have to work again.
Sure. I think it's called a living trust.
Yeah, well, beyond that, I mean, you know, I mean, there's a lot of ways to protect it, to shelter your income from the taxes. But in addition to that, I mean, even if you pay the tax, even if you pay the percentage of the tax, although, as I said, I think that the bottom threshold should be raised, you know, $1 million, that's silly to have an estate tax at $1 million when that's the value of a middle-class house in some cities in America. Unfortunately, tragically, I mean, you know, you've got these housing bubbles in California as a result of Proposition 13. But nonetheless, you know, if we made it a little more reasonable, the threshold, I just don't think that this is, it seems like a good thing to me that we have structures in place to prevent a landed gentry from emerging in the United States.
Yeah.
George, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And I will just very quickly rant about the birth tax, because the birth tax is a very real thing, and that is that George W. Bush is not a tax-and-spend Republican. He is a borrow-and-spend Republican. And when, you know, and this is Ronald Reagan started this big time. I mean, we have borrowed money in the past. We went into debt for the Revolutionary War. We went into debt badly for the Civil War. It took us 50 years to dig out of that hole. We went into debt for World War I to some extent. We went into debt very badly again for World War II. And to some extent to get us out of the Great Depression. And you know, we've worked over the years to steadily pay back those debts. Now, there have been very few years, I'm not sure that there's been any, actually, when the United States was, the deficit was at zero. But the reality is that, you know, all of the history of the United States, from the founding of this country until Ronald Reagan came along, we had not managed to accumulate $1 trillion in debt. And Reagan pushed us, you know, over that, just boom, just like that. By the time George Herbert Walker Bush left office, we were pushing $3 trillion in debt. Well, now we're pushing $7 trillion in debt. And, you know, you divide that amount of money plus all the interest that has to be paid on it into the population of the United States. Over time, what you find is that every child who was born when George Bush came into office was sitting on about $20,000 to $30,000, depending on how you calculate it, worth of American debt that they will have to pay off at some point in their lives. And the majority of it, by the way, certainly more than two-thirds of it, probably more than three-quarters of it, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, the majority of it being debt that Ronald Reagan ran up so that he could make America look like, you know, the economy was doing well, when in fact he was spending us into a hole. I mean, you give me a credit card with $1 million line of credit that somebody else is going to pay, I can show you what it looks like to look like you're affluent. And that's what Reagan did. And now George Bush has more than doubled that. And so now we have about $100,000 debt on every child who is born in the United States. The moment they're born, their birth tax, $100,000, thanks to conservative economic policies. It's nuts. 29 minutes past the hour. We're going to get back to George Bush, leaked memos, Judge John Roberts, and other things in the news. I'm Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back.
Riding around in my Hummer, I never feel insecure.
Yes, indeed.
Everybody knows just where I stand on blood and guts and gore. And since I have to buy more gas every 10 miles or so, I sure am glad we got Iraqi oil to keep me on the go.
Oh, yeah, that Iraqi oil. It's just great.
Riding around in my Hummer, getting the tree huggers pissed. Making all the guys in their SUVs look like conservationists.
Yes. Well, welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here. We're with you 27 minutes before the hour. The Justice Department is opposing a bipartisan effort on Capitol Hill to protect journalists from having to reveal confidential sources, calling the legislation bad public policy. That's an interesting one. We'll get to that in just a minute. First, John in Greenberg, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. I was unfamiliar with you until the local station, WPTT 1360, began picking you up.
God bless them.
Part of a new format.
Yes.
I really wanted to commend you. I think you, in the interview you just completed, as well as the one a couple of days ago, where you were interviewing the gentleman who was going after Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame.
Evan Syed, or Syed, yeah.
Yeah, you've exhibited a quality that to me is very rare in many liberal pundits, which is the ability to get right-wing spinners off their talking points. I think too many in our faction allow them to proceed along the talking point lines and define the terms of discussion. I mean, the gentleman who was trying to defend Karl Rove and the administration wanted to talk about Valerie Plame's Jaguar, or as he called it, you know, her flashy look at me Jaguar, or their predilection for throwing Washington D.C. dinner parties, or inaccuracies in what Joe Wilson said.
Yeah.
None of which has anything to do with whether Karl Rove committed an improper act.
Right. Right.
And then the last discussion, you know. Of course, what the right doesn't want to say is that the so-called death tax, let's not call it a death tax, that's too much of an indulgence, and death is an abstract concept or an event. You can't tax either of those. What you're taxing is a transfer of wealth, which nothing, no more or less. It's just a transfer of wealth between one individual, who is now deceased, to another, the
right.
heir.
It's a transfer of property. And if, for example, I sell you my house and I transfer that property to you, I'm going to pay a tax on that transfer of property.
No different than a sales tax. No different in qualitatively than any sales tax, as you pointed out.
Yeah.
So I'm just calling to commend you for your ability to really sort of put them off balance and take them off the talking points.
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate your kind words. And if you ever run across any conservatives who are willing to come on the program, let us know, because we have a real hard time getting them on the program.
Yeah, I think they'd rather go on, and I hate to say this because WPTT also carries this program at night, I think they'd probably rather go on the Alan Combs program.
Yeah, well,
I call him the step and fetch it of liberal talk shows.
I haven't heard Alan's program enough to be able to comment on it, but okay. Well, we'll leave it at that, because I really don't want to be knocking other people's shows. But John, thank you for your comment. It's good to hear from you, and I appreciate you taking the time to call in. And you know, somebody, I guess somebody's got to be out there against Hannity. I don't. What can you say? Anyhow, the Justice Department, this is an issue that, speaking of talking points, this is an issue that I think that we really need to examine in the United States, and we need to examine it hard. We really need to be thinking about this. This is an issue that really genuinely deserves honest and serious and thoughtful discussion and some serious insight into, and that is this whole thing of the Shield Law for reporters. And and it's actually much larger than just a Shield Law for reporters. It goes way beyond that. Because what has happened is that what we have been saying, what we used to say in the United States, right up until about 20 years ago, what we used to say was there are some professions is the wrong word, and certainly they're not industries. There are some realms. There are some realms, let's say, that are so essential to a properly functioning society that they are sacrosanct, that they are separated from the overview of government to a large extent, that they have their own rules that are different from the rules for everybody else. And so, for example, we said religion is an important thing for many people. Whether you're religious or not, I think you can acknowledge that religion for some people is a vital part of their lives. Or perhaps you define it as spirituality. I probably would prefer that. But nonetheless, this is a vital thing. And so we said we're going to do two things with regard to religion. The first is we're going to say that religion is so important to our society that we're going to bear a good chunk of the cost of religion existing in our society. The way that we do that is by not asking religion to pay for their share of the cost of the commons. Churches don't have to pay for the fire department that protects them. They don't have to pay for the police department that protects them. They don't have to pay their share of the roads that people drive on to come visit them. They don't have to pay for their share of the water purification plant and the sewage treatment plants, assuming the city owns them and it hasn't been privatized, that are providing them with water and sewage. They don't have to pay for their share of the court system that protects them. They don't have to pay for their share of the Treasury Department and the whole infrastructure of our financial institutions and the Federal Reserve System and all that other stuff that allows there to be a currency that can be put in their collection plates every weekend. They don't have to pay for any of that. They are exempt from taxes. We will pay for that because we feel that it's so important that churches exist. And the only thing we ask in exchange for that, for that massive subsidy that we're giving them, such a subsidy that some among them, like Pat Robertson, have been able to become billionaires. Pat Robertson sold Christian Broadcasting Network for $1 billion cash. Or, like Jerry Falwell, become multi-millionaires. The only thing that we ask in exchange for giving them these huge subsidies is that they not engage in political activity. Because political activity could be used to increase their own subsidies. That's the only thing we ask. And in fact, political activity is being, now we discover that in the year 2004, when George Bush was running for president, that by executive order, not by an act of Congress, it couldn't pass Congress, they tried, they failed. By an executive order, George Bush transferred $1,000 million, $1 billion of taxpayer money from you and me directly to churches. And apparently got something for his money. But anyhow, historically, we have said churches are providing a really important function. So number one, the first thing that we'll carve out this thing of taxes for them and just ask them not to be political in exchange for that. And the second thing that we'll do is we will say that the confessional in a church is sacrosanct as well. That what happens, what is said in the confessional just does not leave the confessional. And we'll say that as long as the church agrees that what is said in the confessional doesn't leave the confessional. In other words, back, 400 or 500 years ago, people would go to confess to the church and, talk about their sins, and the church, got to know about it. It's like some cults today. And once the church had the information, they would blackmail people with it. So we said, to the churches, if you won't do that, if you won't use that information for power, we will say that that information is private. Similarly, we said that, physicians, psychiatrists, that information is private. And similarly, we said that because these are essential to provide religious solace and physical health, physicians, and psychological health, psychiatrists, psychologists, psychotherapists, that these three areas we consider to be so important, and these three functions so important, that even if somebody comes in and confesses to some heinous crime, it can be kept secret by that person, by the person who hears that. Because although there may be some crimes that go unpunished as a consequence to that, the benefit to society is so much larger. And similarly, we've said with journalists, if a journalist has information from a secret source, regardless of what that information is, even if somebody comes to a journalist and confesses to some terrible crime, that journalist can protect that source. And the reason for that is because the Fourth Estate was so vital to a functioning democracy that the founders, when they put together the Constitution of the United States, they said, okay, there's three branches of government. There's the legislative branch, the legislature. There's the executive branch, the president, and the FBI and all that kind of stuff. Department of Justice is cabinet level. And there is the judiciary, the courts, and these separate and co-equal branches of government. But really, in the minds of the founders, there was a fourth branch, which wasn't of government, but was intended to keep government honest. It is the only, and that's the press. It's referred to as the Fourth Estate. And it is the only industry that the framers of the Constitution, the founders of this country, the framers of the Constitution, actually plucked out and dropped into the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights says Congress shall make no law restricting freedom of the press. They don't say it shall make no law restricting freedom of the press unless it involves a leak from the White House or unless it involves terrorism. You know, quack, quack, quack. And the reason why is because we got it that even if that means that some crimes don't go punished, even if Karl Rove gets off, that a functioning press is more important than whether or not Karl Rove goes to jail. That was the principle, and that's the principle to which I hold. And back about 20 years ago, this stuff started breaking down. And in the field of psychology and psychiatry and religion, it started breaking down. They started passing laws saying that if somebody learned in the confessional or if somebody learned in a doctor's office about certain types of crimes that have been committed, domestic abuse, sexual abuse, violence, domestic violence, certain types of crimes, that those people then had to report those crimes. They were required by law. And if a doctor heard about one of those crimes or a psychologist or psychiatrist or a priest learned of one of these crimes in a confession, you know, in the confessional or in the privacy of the doctor's office, and they failed to immediately call the police and report it, they themselves could go to prison. And I can tell you from having run a community for abused kids back 25, 28 years ago and worked with psychiatrists and psychologists and social workers that what has happened as a result of these laws is that now if somebody comes in and says that they have a problem with alcohol and they're beating their wife, the person will say, you know, stop right there. I don't want to know anymore, and tell them to leave the office because they don't want to be in a situation where they have to call the police and turn the person in because they're of the opinion that that will do more harm than good, or they don't want to get involved. They don't want to get dragged into it. They don't want to be, you know, indicted for a felony, and they can't provide services because they have to call the police. So what we've done is we've criminalized things that used to be considered medical to a large extent, and that has not worked, frankly. And that same logic has been that didn't work in the medical industry and didn't work in the religious industry, as it were, has been extended into the realm of newspapers, where we're saying, well, they have the right to protect their sources, but. And I'm suggesting not only should we say the right to protect your sources for a journalist is absolute, but that we should also go back and look at the confidentiality provisions and talk to any doctor, any psychiatrist, or any priest about this, and they will tell you how frustrating and difficult it is to deal with this stuff, with the constant threat of legal liability, of criminal legal liability hanging over their heads if they simply hear something. I think that we should revisit all of these things. And the confidentiality of sources in the confessional, in the doctor's office, in the psychiatrist's office, and in the office of the newspaper or, you know, whatever, the television, radio, the reporter, should once again be protected by the force of law in the United States. Used to be. Used to be. For 200 years, they were protected. And now they're not. And I think that they should be again. And people say, well, but then, you know, the judge wouldn't have been able to find out who Karl Rove was talking to. He wouldn't have been able to find out that it was Karl Rove who called up Judy Miller and Matt Cooper. And my response is, that's right. And Karl Rove might have gotten away with it. Now, here's the flip side of that, though. If it's a big story that this leak happened, and Matt Cooper and Judy Miller are keeping their lips sealed, somebody is going to leak it. Somebody is going to say, no, hey, it was Karl Rove. If the press has confidentiality. See, there's somebody, I guarantee you, there's somebody in Karl Rove's office. There's somebody who knows him. There's somebody who goes to church with him. There's somebody who knows one of his kids. There's his babysitter. There's somebody out there who knows what he did. Who, if Judith Miller and Matt Cooper had absolute immunity and refused to testify and didn't have to go to jail, and everybody knew that this story was going to get deep-sixed, and somebody believing that the press could keep a secret would come forward and say to some other reporter, here's who it was. It was Karl Rove. And Karl Rove would get outed. But now, because we're saying, oh, we have to know that it's Karl Rove, therefore Judy Miller has to testify, therefore Matt Cooper can be intimidated, nobody who could have outed Karl Rove will come forward now. Because they know that the press can't keep a secret, legally. And thus, the press is now finding themselves in that same terrible position that priests and doctors and whatnot have over the years. And it's just not a good thing. Not a good thing. So here we have the Shield Law slowly making its way through Congress. Richard Lugar, the Republican from Indiana, Christopher Dodd, Democrat from Connecticut, suggesting a Shield Law. Although it's actually not an absolute shield, which I think is unfortunate. And even that, the Justice Department is opposing. Why? Because this Bush administration wants to be able to scare anybody from talking to a reporter for fear that the reporter will be forced to out them, and then they will lose their jobs, and they will be, you know, they'll come down if somebody, because they're, frankly, this administration is concerned about whistleblowers. Keep in mind, Joe Wilson was the whistleblower here. So, anyhow, that's my rant on that. Give it some thought. We'll be back with your calls and your take on this in just a minute. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I hope you never lose your sense of wonder.
Welcome back, my friends.
Eat your fill to eat, but always keep that hunger. May you never take one single breath for granted. God forbid love ever leaves.
And welcome back. 4.5 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman, and it's our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Steve in Atlanta on the line. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, this is the blueberry down here in the big red bandana known as Georgia.
Okay.
But you know what, Tom?
I lived there for 13 years. I know it well.
The rains of change is going to make it a big crop of blueberries, and the red bandana is fading. You know why?
Why is that?
Because it was made in Walmart.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, I want to disagree with you on this point.
Okay.
You're talking about the media and how they need to be protected.
Yeah.
On this issue, on this particular issue,
yeah.
I don't think it applies simply because the mere act of printing the story is the crime. The mere act of printing the story is the outing.
No, the printing of the story was not the crime. You could argue that when Robert Novak published the story that,
mm-hmm.
you know, I would have no problem with a law that says that if a journalist publishes information that compromises the national security knowingly, then they've committed a crime. That's not, I don't have a problem with that. So, I would go along with it. Novak perhaps should go to jail for what Novak did.
Right.
But the people who got the phone calls from Karl Rove, I don't mm-hmm. think they should go to jail. I don't, and for that matter, I don't even think that Novak should be compelled to tell him, to tell who gave him that information, even though I think the guy's a bum.
I agree that the two that didn't print the story should not go to jail. Novak committed a crime by doing it, in my opinion. He outed him, and then he should, in my opinion, he should.
Yeah, well, I think we're agreeing on that. The Novak should be held accountable for committing a crime of outing a CIA agent. But but still, he shouldn't have to give up his source.
Well, and I, well,
I mean, anyway, we need to separate those two.
I think Fair.org or Media Matters, I can't remember, printed a good article about what I'm trying to say.
No, I read it, in fact, and I know that there's a lot of people on my side of the aisle, as it were, who disagree with me on this. But I just think that this is something where it's a principle, and once you start slicing and dicing it, it starts falling apart,
but
and it'll
reporter,
get shredded.
But the reporter can't be used to make a crime happen, is my point.
Well,
anyway.
Yeah. Okay. We'll go around on another time.
Okay.
We're out of time here,
sure.
Steve. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Thank you to Kareth for engineering our program today, to Louise for producing it. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. Thanks for you for listening. Thanks to the folks who called in. Thanks to our sponsors, particularly Small Dog Electronics, who has been sponsoring this program for a couple of years. High technology at low prices. 1-800-511-MACS. 1-800-511-MAX. For all things computer, check them out. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.